Hello. Tonight, we review The Game, a stylish TV spy series set during the Cold War. Find out how many visitors to the Dulwich Picture Gallery spotted the fake on the wall. And Eleanor Rees, a young Merseyside poet who draws inspiration from the 60s Liverpool scene. But first, get your splurge guns ready because Bugsy Malone and Fat Sam are back. Bugsy Malone is sung by the young cast between the ages of 11 and 20 in a new stage production that opens tonight in London. Bugsy Malone was written and directed as a film first by Alan Parker in the mid-70s. What made it unique was the adult storyline, gangsters in Prohibition New York, with a cast made up entirely of child actors, including 13-year-old Jodie Foster. With slick song and dance sequences and hilarious battle scenes featuring custard-shooting splurge guns, Bugsy Malone was a huge success on screen. It's also long been a favourite for school shows, but for the past 10 years, Alan Parker has refused to allow any professional stage productions, until now. This new one is being staged at the Lyric in Hammersmith, West London, which has just undergone a multi-million pound redevelopment. I went there to meet Alan Parker and director Sean Holmes, who explained why he thought Bugsy Malone was the perfect show to reopen the new Lyric.
I think we're all the generation who loved it, who grew up on it. It was one of the first VHS films for my generation, and I sort of wore it out on the video player. And also, I think the fact that it puts young people at its heart, which is obviously the thing we're trying to do with this new building that we've built. The Lyric's always had a relationship of working with young people. We've been in development for a couple of years now, building this massive extension with new rehearsal rooms, recording studios, small cinema, dance studio, etc., to massively expand the range and quantity of work we can do with young people. And doing such an iconic piece that celebrates the potential of young people just seemed like the perfect match.
Alan Parker, you famously have been quite unhappy about theatrical productions of Bugsy Malone and have refused permission for any professional productions, not school ones. I know you encourage those. Why has that been?
I think there's been two professional West End type shows, and they were both awful, I thought. They were kind of glitzy school plays. You know, I always thought, God, this is such a naff idea. And I can say that because it's actually my idea. So he thought...
Do you think this is more difficult to do on stage than in
film? So much more difficult, yeah. I mean, the thing about film is that it is an illusion. And you can edit it and you can make the kids look a lot better than they probably are, you know. I think up on stage there, those kids are on their own. They've really got to perform, and that's the difference.
So how did Sean manage to persuade you?
I'm from the world of film, and so we're kind of really suspicious of theatre folk because they're usually, you know, very verbose and pretentious. And Sean was the opposite to that, really. And he talked to me in a very normal way, and I kind of thought, actually, it's quite refreshing to have someone to talk about it in an inventive way, really, because I always thought that it needed to be rethought for theatre to be its own thing instead of just a pastiche of my movie.
You know, what Alan's done, which has been really great, is to say, there's the source material, make your own piece of theatre out of that. Now, you'd be stupid to dispense with splurge guns or pedal cars or the iconic songs or iconic characters. But what we have done quite a lot is we've tweaked and changed the structure a bit. There's scenes that are in the film that aren't in it. There's characters that aren't in it.
It's a very big ask because, you know, the Bugsy Malone is built around quite complicated song and dance routines, all of which you have in this. Yeah, I think your actors range in age from 9 to 19. I mean, how big is the total cast? Because it's pretty epic, isn't it?
It is. Well, the specific technical problem is if anyone under 16 obviously has to be licensed and work to very rigorous conditions. So the thing we decided to do, which I think, you know, of course I would say this, but I think has proved to be really successful, is that the lead characters, the iconic characters, are played by children, by under 16. So Bugsy, Blousy, Tallulah, Fat Sam, Fizzy, Babyface and Dandy Dan. So it means we've got three teams of 7, 21 in all. And then on stage every night, there are then 14 of the ensemble who are 16 to actually early 20s, probably. And what's great about that is they're on every night. They are young adults, so their bodies can sustain the dancing. They are more athletic and, trained.
And they can support the younger actors.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And also that they deliver the big numbers. So if you think the people who deliver the big sort of group numbers like Boxer or Bad Guys or Grand Slam aren't children.
I just rewatched the section of your film where Jodie Foster sings "My Name Is Tallulah" and sidles up to men's tables acting in a very seductive way, and backing singers are 12-year-old girls in sort of swimsuits and high heels. My name is Tallulah, my first rule of thumb. I don't say where I'm going or where I'm coming from. Things have changed so much that doesn't look right anymore. Of course, at the time, it seemed fine.
You know, those were more innocent times, it's true. Also, you have to, Jodie Foster was 12 years of age, but actually she was 12 going on 40, because she was by far and away the most adult of all the actors that I had. You know, and the girls, you say, in the background, it didn't occur to us, but actually, we were trying to ape the sort of Busby Berkeley kind of old-fashioned black-and-white movies, really. We did always think it was just a bunch of kids who actually dressing up, in grown-up clothes and pretending to be grown-ups.
I mean, on the other hand, it is 1920s New York. It's the days of prohibition. There's gangsters, dancing girls in speakeasies. So, I mean, it is, adult material acted by kids, and you have to be authentic to that. I mean, how did you approach that, Sean, in those sequences?
In terms of the Tallulah section?
And the young girls. Because, I think you've handled it well. They're wearing dresses that almost too big for them.
Well, that's part of the thing is just to slightly nuance it so you're aware that it's children acting adult roles. There's a long tradition of this because ultimately what it does is it shows the ridiculousness of human behaviour, of adult behaviour, doesn't it? By having kids act out the way adults pay. What could be more ridiculous than gang warfare over sarsaparilla? I think with the Tallulah scene, which is obviously culturally more sensitive now, one of the things is that all the backing singers are now young women rather than 12-year-olds. The Tallulahs are that age between, I think, 13 and 15. But what it was is one of the girls came in for audition and she just played it as if she was the most important person in the room. And I thought that's the way to do it. That's the way to play Tallulah, is just to be above everything. Lonely, you don't have to be lonely, lonely. Come and see Tallulah, we can take some troubles away. And the other thing I think we've done in terms of, now obviously there couldn't be anything more sort of gender specific than a chorus line girl, there's something very specific about that. But in the boxing scene, it's women as well as men. In Bad Guys, the gangsters, there's all the gangs have women gangsters in them. We've just done a thing where we have a group of young.
Which you can do in theatre, whereas
exactly would look crazy. Yeah, it would look. That's right. But because the whole thing is, well, there's not enough of us to do this world, and we have fun with the. We have one character who keeps getting splurged for no apparent reason. And we just acknowledge the theatre, the contract between audience and an actor.
Let's talk about the famous splurge gun. So this is a machine gun that squirts, something that looks like whipped cream or foam. And didn't that pose you huge technical difficulties, Alan, in the original film?
It did. We spent a lot of money on it and it never worked, is the truth. The idea was that we would have, wax balls and inside would be, the whipped cream and they would be fired by this compressed air guns. That was the actual basic theory. And we did the first test on the producer and the production manager, both of whom are very large gentlemen. And they got hit on the head with the first test and it knocked them over. And they had a red mark on their foreheads for about 6 weeks afterwards. So in the film, it's an illusion, really, in that the guns fire ping pong balls. And it was just myself and the prop man, basically, with big hands full of cream, just throwing them at the kids.
Yours looks very messy.
Yes, well, good. That's good. I take that as a compliment, yeah. Tricky, it's the same problem, but we've gone through various permutations. And we fired at our producer, too. And we've basically come up with something which I think works quite well, which is basically paintball guns, but not firing pellets, just firing loose liquid splurge.
Now, Alan, I know you've sat in a couple of rehearsals, I believe, but you're about to go and see it for the first time, given that you walked out halfway the last time it was on stage.
I know, so I couldn't dare do that now.
No. Are you looking forward to it?
I really am, yeah. I mean, just looking at the rehearsals, I'm actually quite excited. I know it sounds a bit corny, but I did lean over to say to Sean, I said, all I asked was that you make it as good as the film, but I said to you never to make it better than the film.
Alan Parker and Sean Holmes and Bugsy Malone opens tonight at the Lyric Hammersmith and runs until August, and I can thoroughly recommend it. Now, as relations with Putin's Russia grow ever chillier, a new six-part series featuring evil KGB officers is starting on BBC Two. The game is set in London in 1972. It's at the height of the Cold War. The Soviet Union is showing off its new ballistic missiles, and the miners' strike in Britain has raised fears of an enemy within. The game begins with a defecting KGB officer revealing the existence of a sleeper cell of agents and fellow travellers within the UK. Jo Lamb is a handsome young MI5 agent who has been tasked with debriefing the Soviet agent over a bottle of vodka in a gloomy London hotel room.
Understand, we cannot discuss payments till your debrief has been completed. Though, of course, our rate of pay increase if you stay in situ and help us gather intel on a more regular basis.
Yes, this is what I want. I'm going to work for MI5.
Well, that's very nice of you.
I have information about a major KGB operation about to take place on United Kingdom soil. It has been named Operation Glass. They're going to tear everything down.
Marcel Jurasz and Tom Hughes in The Game, written by Toby Whithouse. Well, to review it, I'm joined in the studio by the spy thriller writer Chris Morgan-Jones. Chris, obviously you like a good spy story, so were you gripped by this one?
I was. I really enjoyed it. It was enormously likeable, and it was a little like spending some time in the company of a friend that you haven't seen for a while.
Yes, because it plays homage, doesn't it, to all sorts of things like The Third Man and so on, but while at the same time kind of doing something quite new with it.
Well, the writer's a man called Toby Whithouse, who has made very modern television, Being Human, and I think some Doctor Who. And he said that he read The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, being fairly new to the genre, enjoyed it hugely and thought, I'd like to do something in this area. So it has the enthusiasm of a newcomer, And the technical skills of somebody who's completely adept at 21st century television.
Yes, because I'm fascinated by the look, because I mean it's got all the sort of 70s brown and so on, but people are very well dressed. They're very stylish looking.
Some of them are. You'll notice that the more dweeby a character, the more brown they wear. And our hero only wears black and white, and occasionally, in the flashback scenes, grey, which I think represents vulnerability.
Yes, he looks like something out of a Burberry ad, the main character, MI5 agent Jo Lamb, who spends a lot of time bedding secretaries at the Russian embassy and the fragile wives of Eastern European diplomats. I quote a line. He's a sort of male honey trap, isn't he?
He is. I don't know whether such creatures actually existed. But he makes it pretty compelling. I mean, he's implausibly handsome for an MI5 agent, and his hair is immaculate from scene to scene, and that's not terribly realistic. But he's good. He has a certain energy and charm about him.
And, of course, it does remind people of just, you know, how frightened people were in those days of nuclear bombs dropping on Britain. I mean, we really did believe that could happen.
I think it's very good on that. I mean, I was born the year before the action starts, and I can remember the public infomercials about what to do in the event of the nuclear war and what would happen to broadcasting, what would happen to Front Row and other important considerations. And I remember this film that was on in the background, and there's this chilling piece of advice that if there's a dead body in your party, move it to another room and attach identification. So, yes,
it has all of that. But it also has its elements of almost sort of absurdist humour to it. For instance, Brian Cox, who plays the spy master, who everyone refers to as Daddy, and then there's a very camp head of counter-espionage.
All of that, on its own terms, is rather entertaining. Brian Cox is great. He's cuddly and avuncular, but you have a feeling that over the course of the six episodes he might become less so. I'd like it if he did. But, yeah, there is some very broad humour, and some of the real tension it builds up can get a little undercut by it. But in and of itself, each scene is really enjoyable. It's beautifully crafted, and you're there with it.
So you're going to keep watching?
I think so.
Chris Morgan-Jones, thanks very much. And The Game starts this Thursday on BBC Two at 9 p.m. You're listening to Front Row with me, Kirsty Lang. And now for a game of Spot the Fake at the Dulwich Picture Gallery in London. Starting this February, the gallery set its visitors a challenge to identify which of its dazzling collection of old masters had been replaced by a Chinese replica commissioned online for just $120 and then hung in the original frame. Now, nearly 3,000 people submitted their vote via iPads in the gallery, and we've just had the big reveal. The replica was an 18th century portrait of a young woman by Fragonard, and only 10 10% correctly identified it. And if you want to try spotting the difference, there are images of the original and the replica on the Front Row website. But to discuss the project, I'm now joined in the studio by the curator, Xavier Bray. Xavier, was this just a clever ploy to get more people through the doors of the Dunwich Picture Gallery?
It could be seen like that, but actually it took a lot of planning. Doug Fishburne, the conceptual artist who came up with the idea, he's American but based in London, came up with this concept of, you know, how about ordering a replica from a Chinese workshop of one of our pictures and replacing the original with it and see how long it would take to people to notice it. And I said, it could be a good idea, but why don't we curate it and turn it into something that could be a great way to interact with one of the greatest collections of old masters in this country. And we had to, of course, convince our trustees to do this. It took a good year. And there's rich reputational risk, of course, to actually hang a Chinese replica among some great old masters. It's not something that a gallery normally does. But it has to be said, it quadrupled our visitor numbers. People really took up the challenge. They saw it as a great opportunity to test out their connoisseurial skills.
And did you notice them looking at paintings in a different way?
Yes, it was very gratifying. They weren't reading the label first. They went straight to the picture. They would look at it from underneath, look at it under raking light, look at the varnish, see if the cracklier was original or not, look at the brushwork, look at the expressions of the faces. And they had to go through 270 pictures hanging. So it took them quite a long time.
And I understand that quite a few of them thought the replica was in fact a genuine Rubens.
Yes, it's actually, weirdly, it's made me re-look at my own collection in a different way. The Rubens is a beautiful portrait of a woman. It's on panel. It was recently restored 10 years ago, so it has a fresh look about it, I have to admit. But to call it a Chinese replica was, for me, a bit of a shock. But actually, why not? I mean, why? It's polished. It has that sort of...
And it had been recently restored, wasn't it?
So the whites were slightly whiter than other pictures that we have, that the yellow varnish has covered it, you see. So that's one of the reasons I presume people voted for it.
Now, I want to know how easy it is to get a good quality Chinese replica.
It's extremely easy. What you do is you send the JPEG to one of the many workshops that exist in China. There's the most famous village of artists is in Dafen, but we went to somewhere called Xiamen and worked with the Maisheng company, and they asked us if we wanted museum quality or normal quality. We went, of course, for museum quality, and we got back a replica rolled up, FedExed within 2 weeks. We unrolled it. We had to stretch it, of course, and we hung it. And it was extraordinarily simple and very...
I love the idea that there are museum-quality replicas. I mean, who is the market for this kind of, you know... Because I think something like 5 million replicas are produced every year in China.
It's mainly the Americans. George Washington is a favourite. Walmart stocks them and orders them by the truckload. But the rising middle class in China would like to be surrounded by, you know, well-educated images that represent their culture.
Xavier Bray from the Dunwich Picture Gallery, thank you very much. And you can see both the original Fry Gonard painting and the replica hanging side by side at the gallery until July the 26th. And now to a young poet who believes that poetry cannot be properly appreciated without context. Eleanor Rees's context is her home city of Liverpool, which has produced more than its fair share of poets and musicians. Her latest collection, Bloodchild, is heavily influenced by ballads and fairy tales. So were there any particular ones that she drew on?
Well, I worked with a folk singer called Emily Portman on the poem called Sealskin and a poem called The Cruel Mother. She's got an extensive knowledge of traditional ballads as well, so she taught me through some of her favourites, and one of them was The Cruel Mother. So drawing more on that kind of the feel of that work and the opportunity to enter into the fantastical.
But there's also the structure has quite a musical quality. So, for instance, in The Cruel Mother, and indeed the title poem, Bloodchild, there are sections which are reprised in italics, like the chorus of the song.
Yes. Yeah, I was interested in trying to create a poem that's immersive. I did learn a little bit about how ballad singing works, or the idea of the ballad singer as somebody who is voicing or is a conduit for the song rather than emoting their own feelings.
Sail me, city, to heavens below. Sail me, city, into depths of dark. Sail me, city, into the hook of the estuary. Sail me, city.
Recently wrote the lyrics, I think, for a song for the folk singer Emily Portman.
Yes.
Did that feel like a very different process, writing lyrics as opposed to writing a poem?
Yes, it did. I think the language needed to be a little bit more overt, possibly slightly less symbolic in places. My work can be quite visceral and quite lush, and I sometimes have to kind of tone it down a little bit. So I think it was creating that balance.
Your second collection, Eliza and the Bear, was performed live for voice and harp. Mm-hmm. When you first wrote that, did you always intend that to be performed with music?
No, actually. Its first incarnation was as a radio play. I sort of then explored the possibilities for it on the radio, and it's quite a strange piece. And I realised I did want it to be performed. So then I met an actor and we talked about how to speak it aloud. And then I met the harpist and the piece came together. I did not know my lover was a bear. I've seen him bear. I've seen him leave his skin. He roars, bear wet, grisly. Shakes his head, crawls into bed, places a bloody paw on my breast.
There were a number of young poets who were performing their work with music, and I'm thinking of people like Kate Tempest and George the Poet, who've really crossed over into the music industry and sort of blurring the boundaries between poetry performance. Is that a shift that you're aware of within your generation of poets?
I think a lot of us are very concerned with trying to make our work find an audience. You have to work very hard to get interest in poetry. And so I think part of that interest in working with other art forms comes from trying to put poetry back into the context that it perhaps left in the 20th century through perhaps the period of modernist experiment, sort of moving back into community settings or performance contexts.
The very first poem in this new collection, A Burial of Sight, is described as After Esmerdune by Adrian Henry, who was the Liverpool painter and poet. How much of an inspiration was he?
Adrian Henry was a great inspiration, as well as the Liverpool scene, who were a group of poets in Liverpool in the 60s, which included Roger McGough, of course, Brian Patton, and they published one of the best-selling poetry books of all time, which is called The Liverpool Scene, which is now a Penguin classic. What the Liverpool poets were doing was putting poetry back into a community context and back into everyday life, if you like. So they would have happenings, which were multi-art form, working with musicians, working with visual artists, working in performance, and it being democratic, it not being elitist, and it being something for everybody, which is very inspiring. It's something that I felt that I could do.
Bloodshard, the title poem, is also quite scary. I mean, some of the images of this house coming alive, oozing blood. I mean, it's straight out of a horror film, isn't it, really?
Yes.
Could I ask you to read a bit?
Okay, so the poem begins with a refrain. Blood drips from the mouth of the house. Blood floods the dry seas of the moon. The house raises its head, tips back its neck. In the hall, a vase falls south, a ship in a storm. Empty glasses smash their silence inside the empty cabinets. A knitted doll tumbles down stripped wood stairs. And underneath, in foundations, bricks plough down into sandy earth like a rudder, and the bow of the building turns for the river. The roof flips like a flag, and the whole house dredges through the molten earth which parts like waves, splitting the garden wall, tarmac road. Inside the schism, tree roots hang like curls. Blood drips from the mouth of the house. Blood floods the dry seas of the moon.
It is very Nightmare on Elm Street, I must say. I mean, do you like playing with these sort of macabre, disturbing images?
When I was writing it, I didn't think of it as that macabre. It is actually, when I read it now, I'm aware that there's quite a lot going on. I think it's because it gives me an opportunity to work with these more difficult content and try and give it some form that isn't overtly confessional necessarily.
A lot of the poems in your new collection are about transformations, or women or girls transforming into seals, mermaids, birds. What is it about transformation that interests you?
Two things to say. One is in this idea of the local poet, the risk there is that you end up with a provincial or insular idea of the poet, and I want to resist that. So I think something in the metaphor of change, transformation, metamorphosis, is to do with an idea of identity is constantly reforming itself. And it's also linked to how I see poetry. I think poetry is exactly that process. You take one way of being, a certain set of emotions or events, and you change them via your imagination and words into something else.
Eleanor Reeson, her new collection Bloodchild is out this Thursday. We heard today that the Oscar-winning cinematographer, Andrew Lesney, who spent more than a decade working with director Peter Jackson on the 6 Lord of the Rings and Hobbit films, has died at the age of 59. Lesney's other credits include the remake of King Kong and Planet of the Apes. The actor and director Andy Serkis worked on all of those films with him. I spoke to him a short time ago on the phone, and I asked him who set the visual tone on the Lord of the Rings series. Was it the director or was it the cinematographer?
They worked completely collaboratively, and Peter's such a great visionary, and to have this partner who completely could see what was in Pete's mind. I mean, he just had this uncanny ability to sort of see what wasn't there, because so much of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and a lot of Peter's films come directly from Peter's head.
Because as a cinematographer, Andrew Lesney had the challenge of making the landscape of New Zealand both magnificent but also terrifying. How did he achieve that balance?
I think the most extraordinary thing was his ability to take that landscape but also work within a studio and to make what was shot in a studio have the epic quality of, you know, it was seamless, really. The nature of what he shot in studio transferred and plugged into what was outside. You know, and also you've got to remember that he was often shooting things that didn't exist. So the whole CG nature of it all and shooting miniatures and all of those skills that he acquired over many, many years, creating worlds, half of which exist and half of which don't.
Apart from playing the role of Gollum, you were also second unit director on The Hobbit, so directing aerial shots and battle scenes. How ambitious and fearless was Andrew when it came to things like that? I mean, there must have been a lot of hanging out of helicopters with cameras, wasn't there?
Andrew was kind of epitomised kind of fearlessness, really. He loved a challenge. He was always hoiking up the sides of mountains, and you know, you'd find him putting himself in great jeopardy to get the shot and to light it exactly the way that he wanted. And I mean, I've just got a great image of, for instance, him with a crash helmet on, hanging underneath in a fight sequence with King Kong, just sitting underneath as rocks were falling on top of him, you know, a camera pointing up and just wanting to get the shot.
What was the Andrew Lesney look? I mean, what was his signature style in terms of lighting, would you say?
Extraordinary ability to make something look iconic. It felt extraordinarily painterly. That was always the ambition for the sorts of films that I've made with him, and that's what people, I think, really loved. And I know that when Peter Jackson first saw Babe, that was what made him want to work with him on Lord of the Rings. You can pick any frame out of Lord of the Rings, and it has this iconic sense of it, and yet it's emotionally underpinned or backlit, or it just feels the way he moulds a scene emotionally and physically with light has its own look.
What was he like as a person?
The thing is, he was absolutely beloved, totally beloved by the crew, totally beloved by the cast. Everyone had a great time working with him. He had this wonderful anarchic sense of humour and a great love of actors, actually. And his crew would follow him anywhere and do anything for him. He had a very easy authority. He would get excited about every single shot he was working on. He was absolutely infectious on set. His energy and his sense of humour.
Andy Serkis remembering Andrew Lesney. I'll be back tomorrow with The Creators of the Vote, a new play which will be broadcast live on election night. Join us at 7:15.